Lecture 8, Laws, the Legacy of Cephalus.
Well, now that we've looked at Plato's Republic, I'd like to look a little bit further into Platonic political philosophy and talk about the laws. Now, one of the peculiar things about Plato's Republic is the lack of emphasis on law. What we're looking for in the Republic is the rule of wisdom or the rule of knowledge, the rule of the wise. Plato thinks that that's the kind of government that we could legitimize and justify, and that that's what will make us virtuous and holy people. But it seems that towards the end of his life, and Plato wrote the Republic during the middle years of his life, but towards the end of his life, he became much more pessimistic about the possibilities of political order, about the possibilities of real knowledge of the forms. And what he constructs as his last work, which must have taken him the last, it must have been in progress for the last 10 or 15 years of his life, is the biggest and least finished of the dialogues, which is the Laws. And what Plato does in the Laws is what all of us are invited to do, which is to say to criticize Socrates. One of the important ironies of Socratic philosophy is that you can't become Socrates' student until you become Socrates' critic. If anybody ever tells you that, anyone ever tells you that he believes everything you read in the Platonic dialogues, then he hasn't learned anything. Because what you learn is to think critically and to ask yourself, does this make sense? Do I believe this? Do I have good grounds for believing this? So it's not until you start to criticize Socrates, until you reject some of the things that he insists upon, that you really become a Socratic. That's why Socrates is here to stay. Because the more you criticize it and the more you try and get rid of it, the more stuck you are with it, the more indebted you are to Socratic philosophy. So Plato shows himself to be a good Socratic at the end of his life by writing the Laws. And in the Laws, what we're going to get is the construction of the second best society. It's not going to be the best kind of political system, because it seems that the best political system, the rule by a philosopher king who engages in the dialectic, and as a consequence of his strenuous striving towards knowledge, he ultimately finds out about the form of the good and is able to lead his society into virtue and political harmony. Well, it seems that Plato has abandoned that idea of the philosopher king at the end of his life. And the second best source of political order, if it can't be the embodiment of wisdom, is going to be the laws. In other words, a rule of law or a society ruled by laws will be the second best kind of a society if the philosopher king is an inaccessible ideal to us. Now, it could be that there are sources in Plato's life for this sort of move towards pessimism. Plato made several trips to Sicily to try and educate Dionysus, the tyrant of Sicily, with the intention of creating a good political order there. And it turned out that Dionysus was not very philosophical, and in fact Plato found himself in all kinds of political difficulties and ultimately failed in his mission towards bringing philosophy down to this world. And perhaps that just reinforced Plato's idea that the world of the senses, the world of space and time, just wasn't adequate to realize an ideal. But on the other hand, it may have forced Plato to reevaluate his idealism, not in the sense that he rejected the importance of mathematics or the importance of non-change, non-becoming, or not that he underestimated the importance of fixed realities to set your thought upon, but that Plato may have decided that these political and moral forms are not accessible to human beings, or only in dribs and drabs, not in any systematic way. So the laws are going to kind of fill in the gap between knowledge and political order. Now, in the course of the laws, we find the Athenian stranger dominating the conversation. Now, it seems to me that there's a good argument to make that since Socrates has been left out of this last dialogue, this is intended to be explicitly a non-Socratic set of ideas. Instead, that the Athenian stranger represents Plato himself. And if that's too much of a jump, because there's no guarantee that it completely or accurately reflects Plato's views, then it may be one of Plato's masks that articulates a stance that he thinks might be possible in a tentative way, to try and edify if it cannot completely educate. In other words, this may be a way of giving us true opinion in the absence of any kind of true and permanent knowledge accessible immediately to us about politics. So Plato has three elderly men walking in Crete on the way to the cave of Dictae, which is the mythological birthplace of Zeus. So they're going to the origin of the gods. And also very important here is the fact that this is a conversation that happens while three elderly men walk the road during the daytime. Very important. First of all, solar imagery is very important throughout this dialogue. Remember that the form of the good is analogized to the sun in the Republic. In any of the Platonic dialogues, whenever you read anything about the sun, whenever the sun does anything, whether it sets or rises or reaches noonday, underline it because something important is happening. The sun is one of those symbols that moves across the dialogues. Number two, the journey motif. I have said a couple of times that I thought that the Platonic dialogues were an attempt to replicate or to redo the Odysseus myth of the seeker of truth moving in both space and time, but also that being an image of the movement of the mind, of the soul, from ignorance to knowledge. We are going towards the cave of Dicte, the place where Zeus was born, the origin of divinity. And divinity and theology are going to be main themes in the Laws. Plato is nothing if not pious, and his Laws are ultimately founded on religious belief and what he thinks is religious knowledge. The opening line of the Laws is where he asks his two companions, or the Athenian stranger asks the two companions. One is a Spartan and the other is a Cretan. And those, the Spartan and Cretan constitutions, Plato had great admiration for. They were timocratic constitutions. And he asks these gentlemen, Do your laws come from some great lawgiver, or do they ultimately come from the gods? And in both cases, they say, no, our laws were generated by the gods. We have divine backing for our laws. This, in some ways, is a retreat to the earliest foundations of human civilizations. This is, in some ways, a backward-looking dialogue that looks back to the absolute religious reinforcement given to political order in the ancient River Valley civilizations. I think in some ways Platonism might be thought of as a way of bolstering these ancient, archaic, conservative conceptions of society that would have been very happily absorbed into Egypt in the early dynasties, or into Mesopotamia at the time of Gilgamesh, or into the Indus River Valley at the earliest phases of the River Valley civilizations there. My argument then will be something like this. I think that Platonism is much more a backward-looking than a forward-looking philosophy. He intends to recapitulate and improve and refurbish the ancient political and theological order that is characteristic of the most ancient civilizations. He thinks that the results of speculations into natural science and speculations into political science have been an impious, immoral, anti-political tendency which has caused a centrifugal force to blast societies apart. They are no longer held together by the ancient myths. I think that Plato wants to find some logical bones for these kind of invertebrate myths. He wants to show us that, in fact, religion is, and the mythos that surrounds religion, is not opposed to logos. He wants to find an overlap between the mythos and the logos, which makes intellectually respectable the ancient solar myths. The sun in Plato is the image of the good. It is borrowed from an archaic series of myths that goes back to 3000 BC and even earlier. So Plato, in some ways, is the high point, the greatest achievement of the archaic River Valley civilizations. Right, that's something to think about when we look at this. Now, the first three books, there are 12 books in the Laws. The first three books form a kind of preamble to the Laws as a whole. And what they do in the first three books is decide to have a discussion of law, and it'll be a discussion of law and the influence of law on a possible city, not a city that is impossible. Apparently the Cretans intend to found a new city called Magnesia, and the Spartan and the Cretan would like to discuss with the Athenian the best kind of laws, the best kind of civilization, the best kind of political order, with the idea of improving the city in some way that is practical. Even though Plato seems to be at war with the world of space and time and thinks that it's an impediment to true thinking, an impediment to true reality, we have to make some sort of accommodation with the world of space and time. If we do not, worse men will take the job, and a bad situation will become a great deal worse. Now, he asks about the connection between divinity and law, and both the Cretan and the Spartan are patriotic men. They think highly of their kind of society and the kind of polity they represent. And one of the things that the Spartan points out is that the Spartans are abstemious. They do not drink wine because they think that wine is bad for you. That kind of self-control is very important. And a drunken man is an inferior man, a man that is in some way deranged and depraved. And the Athenian stranger says, well, that's true up to a point. The difficulty is that your constitutions are organized around the idea of meeting the external threat, of victory in battle. But you've overlooked, or perhaps your lawgivers have overlooked, an important alternative goal, or not an alternative, but an important supplementary goal. We must win the battle within. In other words, although victory over external enemies is important, victory over the internal enemies is far more important. And that means victory over faction within the city to make it harmonious and unified, to prevent splits from emerging. That's an important goal of the legislator. And secondly, to create harmony and unity within the individual soul. And that's an important goal for the legislator as well. The city is like the man, and perhaps in a more attenuated way than we found in the Republic, but they're certainly connected. Now, Plato says, it is good that the Spartans are not depraved in their handling of drink. It's good that they're not chronic drunks. But potentially, Dionysus, the god of drunkenness, and wine itself could be a good test. Because many times we notice that Spartans have been susceptible to the lure of money, the lure of sex, the lure of wine, when they had access to it. The key thing that a wise legislator will do in the process of educating, he will note that in vino veritas, and we will test young men by giving them wine and seeing what sort of reactions occur. If they can handle their liquor, you will find something about their soul. If they can't, then you will find that they are not morally or spiritually organized men. So it will be good for men to be tested with liquor as a way of finding out what their soul is like, so long as there's always an elder, sober man among them to supervise these proceedings to make sure it doesn't become debauched. In some ways, this is a very wise procedure. What this symbolizes, and I think this is very important, is this sober elder man in this city, which is primarily concerned with solar events and solar things, is that what we have here is the symbolic triumph of Dionysus, of Apollo over Dionysus. In some ways, all of Platonic philosophy is an attempt to take Dionysus, the realm of the irrational, the realm of the drunken, or the desiring, or the erotic, and to organize that, not to abolish emotion, not to abolish desire, but to strictly regulate that, and regulate it by the god of order, the god of the muses, the god of music and poetry, Apollo over Dionysus. And he's also the sun god, right? So connect that back up with the form of the good. So what we're going to try and do is make sure that wine is used to test the young men and also to make the old men vigorous. He thinks, here's what you want to do. We want to make sure that our choral music and our choral dancing, which will be an important part of the education of the society, are kind of lively. And we want to make sure that everybody believes that the happy man is the good man, is the virtuous man, and there is no happiness in illicit pleasure. So after dinner, after a sober and sedate dinner, the elder men, over 40, will be allowed to pass the bowl around. And of course, a Greek wine bowl holds half a gallon or a gallon. I mean, it holds a lot. It's not like a shot glass. So they'll pour a large bowl and they'll pass it around. And they'll get not unseemly in their drunkenness, but they'll become slightly intoxicated. That point of intoxication where you begin to find yourself interesting, right? You know what I'm talking about? Well, what we want is the old men, the men over 40, to find themselves kind of interesting, because that will kind of add a little spring to their step and make their singing that much more entertaining. And they will sing, strangely enough, hymns. Hymns showing that the good man is the wise man, is the virtuous man, is the happy man. We're good, wise, virtuous, happy men. We've had a few drinks, and we find ourselves interesting, and we like to educate the youth with our sprightly step and with our fine choral performances. And of course, other choruses will follow in age groups, which will be singing the same song. The idea is that they will see that these happy old men are telling us that virtue and justice and goodness and happiness and pleasure are all really the same thing. This is the taking of Dionysian emotion, particularly the drunken orgy, and organizing it along perfectly Apollonian, geometric, very Greek lines. A very beautiful conception, both symbolically and kind of nice as a concession to the life of pleasure. Not that pleasure is an end in itself, but we wouldn't want to completely separate it. Asceticism doesn't fit very well into the Greek view of things. Now, we educate, we even take Dionysus for our purposes, and we use that to educate the young men, young women, that virtue is the real pleasure. The poets will be censored, but even though the poets are censored, we will have our own good poetry. That's one of the holdovers from the Republic into this ideal city. And in Book 3, they talk about the founding of a first city. And in this case, he talks about the possibility of a cataclysm. Every once in a while, an earthquake or a tidal wave or a flood wipes out a city. We have to go back to the city of utmost necessity, which would be like the city of swine that's described in the second book of the Republic. Okay? So we'd have to start anew. We get a blank slate. And what Plato's interested in doing now has many differences from his project in the Republic. Because in the Republic, he was trying to find a synthesis of Athens and Sparta. He wants to take those Ionic tendencies, those tendencies of those cosmopolitan, worldly, skeptical tendencies that we find in the Ionian city-states, the places that generated Ionian physics, and we want to connect that with the severe, Doric, kind of abstemious kind of life that we see in Sparta, and the relatively rude and crude origins that that has. It's not cosmopolitan, it's very provincial. What Plato wants in the Republic is to bring together the Ionic and the Doric, the Ionian and the Doric. He wants to bring together Athens and Sparta to form some super state that would be superior to all of them. Well, in the Laws, we get a different project. Here, he wants to try and unify Athens, which represents democracy, not with Sparta, but with Persia, which represents monarchy or actually autocracy. In other words, a big polity and a little polity, a polity in which we get complete obedience to the government, compared with polity in democracy in Athens, which is not in complete obedience, in fact has a lot of license in it. So he wants a combination of order and freedom. He wants a combination of flexibility and rigidity. So he's somewhat changed his goal in this dialogue. And to choose the laws, or a society based on laws, trying to find a mixed polity which will create something between Athens and its spirited but turbulent people and Persia with its completely supine yet very orderly people is just what he wants. He wants the best of both worlds. Now, after the first three books form a kind of preamble to the next nine, we actually set up the city, starting in books 4 and going all the way through books 12. And this city, first of all, Plato wants to find out what its practical resources are. In this case, it's kind of it will be echoed later on in Montesquieu. Before we set up our city and decide what the laws are going to be, we have to know where it's going to be, what its resources are, does it have a natural harbor? In other words, he wants to find out tables and chairs, practical things first. This is certainly a concession and a move away from the Republic, where we first want to find out what do the forms tell me? What does the form of goodness inform me about what I'm supposed to do? Here he says, no, let's reverse that slightly. Let's see what practically in space and time we're dealing with first. So he says, is it self-sufficient? Will it have good farmland? Will it have to trade? Does it have a harbor? Things like that come first. And in particular, he talks about the fact that he would like few foreigners allowed in. Athens, of course, is a city of foreigners. It's a commercial city. They don't have enough farmland to feed their people, so they constantly have to import grain, and that means something has to go out if something comes in. It's these foreigners that have made Athens very heterogeneous and very open to innovation. And Plato, like the Republic in the Laws, is opposed to innovation. He says, look, if we get it right finally this time, every innovation you could make has to be a deterioration. If we don't get it right, well, then we don't, I mean, then innovation isn't such a danger, but we're trying to get a good society here. So Plato, in the Laws, as he was in the Republic, is against innovation. He says he wants to halt history, essentially. All historical change should be stopped. Well, he wants a state divinity. He wants a state cult and state religions. Those become our state religion. That is the most important difference, or the most important big difference between the Laws and the Republic. There's a much greater emphasis on religion. It's not that the Republic didn't have a state cult and state festivals and religious rites and things like that, but in the Laws it's made much more apparent and it's stressed a great deal more. The first line is, he asks the Spartan and the Athenian, you know, are their laws human or divine? And here Plato wants to argue that law and lawful government is essentially backed by the divinity, like all political order is. And law, in addition to being a kind of divinity and a kind of theology, should also be a kind of poetry, which is a very interesting idea. In some ways, Plato was such a profound poet that everything he touched turned into poetry. And if he's going to write something about laws, well, then you can be sure that we're going to have very poetic laws, and these laws will be intended to be poetic in the sense that they're educative. Remember that he criticized tragedy and criticized comedy and criticized epic because the poets are the true legislators of the world, they're the true educators. And if people are badly educated through poetry, they become wicked and they become vicious. Well, Plato is going to write poems in the form of laws, and at the beginning of each law, he tells us what the form of the law will be. All laws will not just be simply will not simply state what you can't do and what the punishment is. Before they tell you what you can and can't do and what the punishment will be, there is a preamble to every law which exhorts the people to obey this law because it is a necessary and beneficial and good law. And a good man or a good woman will obey this good law because they want goodness of the soul and goodness of the city. So in other words, instead of having philosopher kings educate the city, because the philosopher kings are going to be left out of this project, we're going to have the laws be the educators of the city. And the laws will in some ways supersede the poets. The poets will be subject to the laws and will have to create their poems and create their religious festivals and their religious songs strictly in accordance with these laws, which will guarantee us, if not a perfect city, at least the best city humanly available. So law will be a kind of poetry, and it will be instructive. And education will be the function of this society. In other words, the most important thing that happens in the city of the laws will be education. Education is the bedrock upon which everything else is founded. Now, in addition to education, there will be various classes in the city. For example, there will not be communism, there will not be the abolition of the family as we saw in the Republic. Those ideas were too radical. They just weren't practical. So what Plato is going to have instead in the city of the laws is, first of all, four classes based upon the amount of money that they have. But the amount of money the people are allowed to have is strictly limited. In other words, everyone gets one household. Every adult male head of household gets a plot of two plots of land, and he works it with his family and the other people that work for him. And the highest amount of money that anyone can own is four times that one household. In other words, there's a strict upper limit and a strict lower limit. You're not allowed to sell your patrimony. You can't get rid of your land, which means that we're not going to have any group of very wealthy people. We're not going to have any group of very poor people. There will be a rough equality, but not perfect equality, because people will be coming into this new society bringing different amounts of property with them. There's no way to completely eliminate these disparities in property. The best we can do is strictly regulate them so the city doesn't factionalize on the basis of wealth. Plato thinks that wealth is, in that respect, a necessary evil. And what he's going to say is that we're going to have strict boundaries on the use of wealth. If you accumulate more than that four households' amount of wealth, then you have to contribute it to the gods. And then you help build temples and things like that. A very sensible way of using it for the public good. Again, he's concerned with undermining the distinction between public good and private good. Now, in addition, there will be no credit, no money, just about nothing in the way of commerce. He'll have a small circulating medium within the city made of metal of some kind, of some base metal that's not worth anything outside the city. Why? Because he doesn't want to engage in much foreign commerce. He's looking for self-sufficiency. And he's also looking to completely fix the size of the society. He wants 5,040 hearths, I believe. I believe that was the number that he chose. Now, there's a lot of Pythagorean number magic here. But 5,040 is chosen as the right number of households in the city, first of all, because it's divisible by all the numbers from 1 to 12, I believe. So for tax purposes, the calculations are easy and things like that. But in addition to that, it seems that there's quite a bit of Pythagorean numerology here. In other words, Plato has I don't know if it's mysticism, but there's a kind of playing with numbers that you'll find. There's 12 is the big number here. Each of these 540 families taken together will be broken into 12 tribes. And these 12 tribes will be in 12 areas in the city. And the city, nobody will be able to sell their land. And so we'll have no very rich people and no very poor people. And each number of tribes will have the same number of people within it, the same number of households, and that will be fixed forever. In other words, there will be, on the average, two children per household. If a household has more than two children, then they have five sons or six sons, then they will lend their children out to people that don't have children, so we make sure that the same number of people in the city at all times. And if we have too many people, we will start a new colony rather than expand the size of our city. So we're not going to have an expansionistic foreign policy. It's going to be utterly fixed. 5,040 families divided into 12 tribes who occupy 12 areas of the city. Now, these 12 tribes will each, for 1 month out of every year, take control of various kinds of government offices, policing the state, making sure the public works are done, and things of that kind. Stop and think about this. 12 is a very interesting number. This city is a giant solar calendar. In other words, we're going to go round and round the circle of the year, and it's never going to end like a circle. We're going to do it again and again and again. This amounts to the abolition of history. In other words, we're not going to have linear time. We're not going to be going towards some end. We're going to go round and round the big revolutions of the cosmos. In other words, this city is a microcosmos. It is a small example of the whole universe. 12 months of the year, 12 tribes, each taking their place year in, year out. Exactly the same number of hearths or households within each tribe. All the tribes are equal. And we go spinning round and round and round. In a way, this is Apollo, the god of order, also the god of the sun, over Dionysus, disorder and disorderly emotion. Now, there'll be various magistrates running this city in a fixed way according to fixed laws, because Plato wants being, not becoming. He wants static, changeless qualities, not flux and alteration. So what he wants to make sure is that there's a representative assembly which will be voted for by everyone with certain kinds of qualifications. He'd like to see the wealthier people have a little bit more influence, but not so much more influence that they'd be inclined to tyrannize over the poorer people. He thinks that there's some, perhaps, connection between the accumulation of wealth and good qualities of the soul, foresight, diligence, organization of the emotions. So he wants to give some slight added weight to the votes of the fewer people, who one assumes would be wealthier, but they won't be but so wealthy, and they won't have enough power that they might choose to tyrannize. At least that's the theory. On the other hand, everyone takes part in certain kinds of voting, and the voting is supplemented with lots, and in addition, there will be other governmental officials besides these magistrates and this representative assembly. Women, for example, will be called upon in a governmental office to form a committee to supervise all married couples and supervise family life and supervise reproduction. So they have governmental functions. And if after 10 years a married couple doesn't have children, they'll inquire into this, because you've got to remember, we have to have two kids for that household, right? So, and if they're not reproducing, we have the possibility that one of our hearths will go unfilled, and we don't want any changes. So women will supervise family life and at least the early upbringing of children, and it will be a governmental function, because education will be the crucial issue in this kind of a government. The most important political post in this, in all the various and very complicated kinds of governmental committees that Plato generates in these laws, is the Minister of Education. Strangely enough, but true. The Minister of Education will be a man over 50. He will have children of his own, preferably of both sexes, and will be a wise, virtuous, good man. Not a philosopher, a king, but still, he will be chosen for a 5-year term, and he will supervise what we usually think of as education, the process of, you know, schooling and teaching and the teachers and what gets taught, but also things like religious rites, songs, poems, all the things that go into an education in Plato's extended sense. You will not innovate with your religious hymns until the Minister of Education has seen them and okayed them and made sure that these tell the truth about the gods, that virtue is happiness, is justice, is goodness, is restraint of the soul. In other words, there may be innovations, but these innovations will all be superficial. The meaning of these innovations will all be to reinforce the same basic idea that the happy man is the good man, is the virtuous man. Virtue is goodness, is eudaimonia. And that's what you're going to get taught again and again and again. So, and the most important and influential official in Plato's laws is the Minister of Education. Now, schooling will be universal and compulsory for both sexes. Platonic feminism comes back in. That's been held on to. Plato thinks it is a great pity and a great waste of human resources that women not get an education. And even that poor children should not get an education. Disgraceful and foolish. So for the first time, we have a proposition that there will be universal and compulsory education for all children. And the education starts before you're born. In other words, the women who supervise reproduction and family life will make sure that women who are carrying children eat the right foods and get the right exercise, because it's thought that that will create a vigorous child, and that's really good for the kids. So the kids' education is being supervised at the prenatal stage. And from womb to tomb, thereon, all of the education will be supervised until he moves up, or he or she, the child, moves up into a position of adulthood, gets married, and then perhaps becomes part of the government themselves. So there will be education for the youth, which will be compulsory after 6. First of all, they'll learn weapons. Why? Because they're going to have to defend the city. War is a fact of life, and we may be attacked. We're a small city, so both men and women will learn the use of weapons, like the silver people did in Plato's Republic. In addition, they will learn religious hymns and poems, good poems, praising good men doing good things. So there won't be any Homer, or the Homer we keep will be only the good parts of Homer, and probably very little tragedy and very little comedy. What we'll have instead are religious songs saying that Apollo really likes order, really likes discipline, really likes virtue, and that all our gods really like the good things, and our gods are good, and our people are good, and we will be happy and blessed like the gods when we do divine and godlike things. In addition to that, there will be no sophists allowed in this city. There will be higher education, though. Higher education will take the form of mathematics and astronomy, which are, well, of course, mathematics speaks for itself because that's on the top side of the divided line. But of all the empirical inquiries, the disciplines here in this world of space and time, the most celestial, the most divine, will be the study of these celestial divinities. So astronomy will be a kind of bridge from the world of the senses to the world of pure knowledge. Perhaps we don't get the same emphasis on the realm of the forms in this book that we do in the Republic. I think that Plato thinks that the realm of the forms has become shaky towards the end of his life, but he does think that knowledge and education are the key political questions, and that these key political questions can be resolved only by completely organizing, and once it's well organized, completely avoiding change in education. There'll be one education for everybody, and those with greater aptitude will go on towards further education. No sophists, education in math and astronomy. Now, education will be sacred because our religious festivals are designed for us to have competitions among the poets for who can make the best praise of the gods and who can say the nicest things about virtue. And so we will allow for some innovation, but it'll only be an apparent innovation. The meaning and the message of these poems, of these constructions by the poets, will be that the happy man is the good man, is the virtuous man. In addition, there will be athletic games, the way the Greeks had games at Olympia, that will be connected to religion. So both the development of the body and the development of the soul will be made sacred. So our education is connected with our religious rituals. And religion is what backs up our government, remember. This is going to be a theocratic kind of Pythagorean government of people with special religious knowledge or religious intuitions. And these religious intuitions are made manifest through the art, through the architecture, through the poetry, through the laws. In other words, everything in this society converges on education, on the improvement of the psyche. Now, this microcosm will be kept whirling around the calendar and whirling around the city. 12 tribes, 12 books to the book called The Laws. The Dialogue of the Laws is broken into 12 parts. And we will constantly be replicating the universe in our city. And it'll be an orderly universe. Plato's physical universe, if you read the Timaeus, is an orderly universe constructed by God. And God is behind the order that's in both the universe and the cosmos, and in our microcosmos, our little cosmos here. So we have created a replica of God's order, God's best structure for human political social life. Now, we will live a very regulated life. There will be no adultery, there will be no homosexuality, there will be very limited kinds of transgression. Plato wants us to have orderly souls in an orderly society. And that means that people will supervise what would otherwise be described as personal behavior, and that the laws will be organized towards educating people into what good behavior is. That's why they have a preamble at the beginning. And if people transgress nonetheless, and here's a movement towards pessimism, away from the optimism we saw of the Republic that perfect education gives you perfect people. Here he says, look, even if we educate them with these very fine laws and these very fine religious rituals, they may well transgress. Perhaps they will. Well, then we have to work on the theory of punishment. And Plato makes great contributions to legal theory here, or to what might be called jurisprudence, by saying that all punishment is educative. In other words, the only reason you punish anyone for breaking the law is because they don't know any better. They think breaking the law is good. So laws and punishment, law is supposed to be educating from the word go. If the preamble to the law fails to educate and somebody transgresses anyway, then you punish them in such a way as to create education for them, make them understand what virtue is or why they should obey that law. So whereas Athenian law is retributive, in other words, you do something bad to the transgressor because they have retribution coming to them. Plato gives up on that whole idea. He says the only reason anyone should ever be punished is because you want to make them understand that this law is a good thing and they ought not to do that. You're doing this to educate them. The laws are the ultimate educators in this society. So Plato says, for those who can be reclaimed, who don't have completely corrupt souls, you do something to them. You whip them or you put them in jail or something like that, only insofar as it's necessary to have them understand what real virtuous conduct is. On the other hand, for those that are just so corrupt and so evil, here we're talking about people that engage in treason or parricide or some terrible, terrible transgression, those, you hang them, you kill them, or you do something bad to them, because you can't teach them. You can't teach them how to be good, and so their punishment is exemplary. You're going to use their punishment to teach everybody else. You see what happens to wicked, corrupt souls? You see why this is a bad thing? Well, it's bad because it's bad in and of itself, transgressing this law against parricide, but it's bad also for what it gets you, because it gets you the fullest punishment of the law. So punishment is either directly educative or it's exemplary, designed to educate the rest of the society. Now, this is a great breakthrough in thinking through the theory of punishment. The idea of giving up retribution 24 centuries ago is quite sophisticated. It hasn't been abandoned in every part of our criminal code, I would guess. So this is a very sophisticated, very well thought out argument. What Plato does in this is separate torts or mere damage from intentional transgression. In other words, if my ox eats some of your hay, right, it's not because I had any ill will towards you. So I'll have to pay you for the cost of the hay, but no one's going to punish me because I didn't ask the ox to do that. You know, I'll tie my ox up better later on. But if I stole your hay myself, well, then I'll have to pay you back for the hay minimally. But also I'm going to have to be punished because that shows a depravity of my soul. I have not been educated appropriately by the laws. So I'll be punished not as retribution for stealing hay, but in order to be reminded that it's bad to steal. Right. A very sophisticated idea for 24 centuries ago. Right? I think that there's much to be learned from that. Now, in the 10th book, in some ways this is the most interesting and important of the books of the laws, he talks about theology. Plato invented the discipline called theology. There was no theology prior to him. I mean, there was poetry about the gods and daemons, and there were various speculations about the nature of divine things. But theology as a systematic activity, which is connected to other kinds of knowledge, it begins with Plato. He thinks it up. And Book 10 is about theology. What he says here is very important, because particularly people that only read the Republic don't get a completely accurate understanding of Plato. It's clear enough that Plato is worried about the influence of Ionian physics, of pre-Socratic science, on the political and moral order of Greece at the time. And he says explicitly in Book 10 of the laws, where he talks about theology, he says, our real problem is this. Naturalistic thinkers, physicists, materialists, who have given us mechanistic explanations of the world, have demythologized not just nature and the planets and the stars and the trees and the rocks, they have also demythologized our laws. They have demythologized our political and moral order. And the result is chaotic nihilism. The result is that there's a moral vacuum that gets filled by the sophists. So the sophists are, and the lying poets who are very much like the sophists, are the kind of spiritual grandchildren of the Ionian physicists. And when the Ionian physicists decide that we have a non-religious, non-mythological, non-divine nature, that means that our political order crumbles and we get straightaway power politics. So Plato says our real problem in keeping back this disorder of maintaining internal political and moral coherence involves showing that the world is divinely ordained and divinely organized, and creating a sort of mythos of nature which will allow us to have our cake and eat it too, which will allow us to have a new sophisticated science and at the same time allow us to have political and moral order. So Plato thinks he can do this. Now, it's better men have tried and perhaps failed, but Plato believes that there are certain facts about the divine, about divinity or theology, which are accessible strictly to the unaided reasoning mind. And what Plato makes here is an argument from design. And this is well known in the history of philosophy. The idea is that the world clearly has an internal coherent order to it. Things don't happen arbitrarily. Rather, the movement of the stars and the sun and the moon and things like that clearly show a plan to the universe. Well, what Plato wants to say is that the plan, the design that is evident in the structure of the universe, implies that there is a divine logos, a divine mind behind it. And Plato says, this is the real problem. Once you can demonstrate the argument from design, and Plato thinks he can, and I'm not going to argue for it because I don't believe the argument from design, but Plato thinks that he has generated a real intellectual breakthrough here. He has made theology intellectually sufficient, intellectually serious, by bringing it up to logical speed, by making it intellectually a competitor with the naturalistic, mechanistic sort of nature that you get in Democritus or Empedocles. Plato says once he's demonstrated this, anyone who denies the existence of the gods will be locked up, not with the idea of punishing them once again, but locked up so that professional smart guys, the members of the council, can come in and talk to them and explain to them, look, the argument from design shows us that the world does really contain gods, and by implication it contains a moral order because the gods are good and the gods are wise and the gods are perfect. He thinks, in addition, that there are two other heresies, and he has a very limited idea of heresy. What his idea of heresy is that all contradictions, everyone who contradicts these facts of revealed natural religion will have to be sequestered so they don't do harm to the society. Well, he says, first, anybody who believes that, the hedonistic argument of Epicurus that the gods exist, but they don't care about us. They're not interested in little worms like us. He says that's not true, too. The gods aren't lazy. The gods aren't foolish. The gods aren't tired. If the gods exist at all, they're certainly going to be interested in us because they're interested in everything. The third question, the third kind of heresy that he wants to go against is the kind of heresy that's given by Cephalus in the beginning of the Republic, where he says, well, look, I'll buy the gods off. You know, I did a lot of bad stuff, but now I got some money to spend on sacrifices. I'll bribe the gods and I'll get out of divine retribution. Plato says, no, of course. If the gods are good and virtuous, they don't lack anything. They don't need your sacrifice. For that reason, they will give divine retribution because they're interested in moral order. The gist of this is that the fundamental bedrock of Plato's new society, of the laws, will be on a kind of rational theology that generates these laws. This is the second best kind of regime. It is obvious that Plato does this with great reluctance. But if he can't have the philosopher king, if he has some doubts about the theory of forms, because perhaps the theory of forms is in trouble, as I'll try and show tomorrow, then the next best thing he could do is to create some kind of political order on a connection between mythos and logos, having a set of instructive laws which are backed by divine sanction. Now, in some ways, the high point of this book is Book 10 on theology. The two other books, it's clear that Plato, I mean, he died when he was 80, and this book was still kind of a rough draft. It wasn't completely finished. So there's some signs towards the end of the book that it's kind of tapering off. Book 11 is a kind of miscellaneous, heterogeneous bunch of things about wills and being disinherited, and it obviously isn't quite finished. There's not much drama going on there, not much back and forth either. It's much more like a legal treatise. And the final chapter 12, is where Plato establishes the Nocturnal Council. Now, this is kind of an echo of the gold citizens, of the highest and finest, the most intelligent of the citizens running society. He's reconnecting politics, or virtue and knowledge, and politics and knowledge. And the Nocturnal Council will be the oldest and wisest of the magistrates, with 10 young men who are between 30 and 40 that are being groomed for the highest positions in the state, and the Minister of Education and a few other important officials will meet in this council. And it's called nocturnal because they meet an hour before sunrise every morning to discuss the various problems in the society. And they get a special kind of an education that takes them a little bit beyond the usual kind of education that's given to citizens of this sort of society. They study mathematics, astronomy, dialectic, ethics, theology. It will be in some respects like the education that Plato wanted to give the guardians in the Republic, except that it's not clear that any one of them will emerge as a philosopher king, and it's also not clear that dialectic ultimately leads them to the forms. Dialectic is there. They're going to have to talk about the one and the many and the unity of the virtues and all that kind of Platonic stuff, but I don't think Plato is placing as much emphasis on dialectic and as much emphasis on the forms as he does earlier in the middle of his career. This is the last book. He has some doubts about these things, but he leaves the Nocturnal Council around to do what they can to drive this society forward in terms of knowledge and virtue. So virtue and knowledge are still the same thing, and the Nocturnal Council will still try and be a sort of faint echo of the golden citizens of the Republic. But because we can only have the second best kind of regime here in this world, Plato's Laws represents a retreat from the optimism towards a sort of pragmatic pessimism. And Plato's Laws is a society in which we do the best to replicate the order of the universe both in ourselves and our society. And Plato says, if that isn't perfect, it may be the best that we can do.